Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday here on Colorado's 50,000 watt AM 670 KLTT. And throughout 20 years now on air, we've had a long history of debating evolutionists and atheists and interviewing creationists. But as of yet, we haven't talked to a single leader in the growing intelligent design movement. Now, I'm just going to reminisce down memory lane for a moment. I have had the opportunity to debate Eugenie Scott, and for the 10-year anniversary of that program, we exhumed Eugenie and replayed that debate in which she claimed explicitly that all non-coding regions of DNA were affirmatively known to be useless, and so that junk DNA was the best evidence for Darwinism. So that's Eugenie Scott. I've interviewed an atheist editor at Scientific American, Michael Shermer, who in his determination to disagree with any and all things Christian, Michael refused even to agree that the Bible was correct when it said that the sun is not a god, but that it's a light, to which Shermer stubbornly responded, "The sun is not a light." That's on our website, of course. I've recently debated well-received British author and Darwinist James Hannum, after which he so kindly reported that his side, the evolution side, did not fare nearly as well as he thought it would regarding which side could best muster scientific evidence. And then PZ Myers has occasionally blogged against our radio program, Real Science Friday, including last week regarding our trochlea challenge to him about the eye muscle that's routed through a pulley. And then Richard Dawkins actually vindicated a claim made on this program on air back in 1997 when we categorically stated that not one of his books provided evidence for evolution. And now, as you can see and hear online, we juxtapose that clip with Richard Dawkins in his own voice a dozen years later when he admitted that none of his books had ever presented actual evidence for evolution. So with that rundown, the omission is an interview with a leader from the intelligent design community, ID. One of the DVDs we sell, The Privileged Planet, caused quite a stir when it was scheduled for a showing in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian. And one of the scientists involved with that project is Discovery Institute fellow Dr. Jonathan Witt. And along with William Dembski, Jonathan Witt wrote a great book, which I've just read, called Intelligent Design Uncensored. And so I'd like to welcome to Real Science Friday, intelligent design author and researcher, Dr. Jonathan Witt. Welcome, doctor.
Hello, good to be on the show.
Thanks for writing this super book. It starts with a look at the cell. You guys give us a tour of what it would be like to become miniature and go inside a cell. Can we try to give the audience just an idea, a word picture of that marvelous complexity?
Yeah, and what motivated that word picture that we start with is to help shake readers out of the image that Darwin and many scientists, whether they were evolutionists or not, back in his day, 150 years ago, had of the cell. The notion of it was a cell is the simplest form of life. It's small. And so it was quite simple in their minds. It was a little more complex than a sack of Jell-O to their minds. But after 150 years of improved microscope technology, we now know that the cell is fantastically sophisticated. And so we have this whimsical opening where the people win a lottery to go on a space flight.
Right.
And there's five or six of them, three or for them, and they get on board the ship and they take off, and they see themselves moving at one point toward this what looks like a small moon. And as they get closer and closer, it looks almost like a space station, and it's got things, little ships coming in and out of it. And then they actually fly into it, and they're like, what is this? And then finally, okay, of course, it comes out that rather than flying to space, they've been miniaturized, and they're looking at what they think is this extraordinarily sophisticated space station with all kinds of technology and information systems, machines shuttling objects and information to and fro. But then they're thinking, I don't think the human race is this advanced yet. And you know, they're kind of embarrassed to think that, are there aliens, space aliens that are more advanced? Is that it?
Right.
And then finally the answer comes out, no, they've miniaturized themselves and they've flown into a living cell, which is a micro-miniaturized factory, one scientist called the cell, though more sophisticated than any factory that we have ever been able to create. So that's how we begin the book, Intelligent Design Uncensored, to shake people out of this notion that there is really anything such as simple life. Life at its smallest stage is already extraordinarily sophisticated, far more advanced than anything humans have been able to create.
Jonathan Witt, there is a very sophisticated animation of life in the cell online. You could find it so easily at YouTube. We link to it occasionally from our website. And Ben Stein, in his movie, I think they used that as a template, and they brought people for a tour like you're describing. And the machines, the molecular machines, that there are thousands of different kinds of machines. And within a single cell, there are millions of these machines, each doing very specific and vital functions. And one of the most amazing is a device that walks along what looks like a railroad track, and it's pulling a huge sack of supplies that's needed in a different part of the cell.
The evolutionist take on the history of life is that in Origin of Life studies, somewhere along the line, the first single-celled organism came into being. In Darwin's time, they thought, oh, that wouldn't be complicated because simple life is simple. Now we know that the most basic life form that can self-reproduce, you've got to have reproduction before the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection can kick in.
Right.
That is fantastically complex. And we talk about that in the book. Just to get a self-reproducing single-celled organism involves micro-miniaturized technology that's just breathtaking.
And the
scientists still haven't figured out the layers of complexity yet. It's so fantastic. And you've got to start with that. You can't use Darwinism to explain the first cell.
The first,
because you have to have all those pieces together before it could start reproducing and having the mutations that supposedly drive Darwinian evolution. So that's a big, big problem, a big, big hurdle for those scientists who want to come up with a purely naturalistic story for the history of Earth, for the history of the emergence of life, a big hurdle. And some of those who are committed to that story will even admit that they really have no satisfactory explanation for the origin of life.
At this point. Even though they say, well, we have the whole world as a laboratory and we have a billion years for life to get started, in reality, these are micro machines. And so you need dozens of functions to come together, not over a billion years, but all within the tiniest space and all at the same time. It doesn't do you any good to, by random chance, get half of the features you need for life together in one spot. You need them all. And like you said, natural selection isn't going to help the process until you have a reliable reproduction mechanism.
Right. And a book I had the privilege of reading and giving a little input on before it came out that is just focused on the origin of life, and it's called The Signature in the Cell. Somebody wants to go really into depth on the origin of life, I would recommend that. If you want a short, several-page summary of it, I would recommend our book, Intelligent Design Uncensored. But in that longer book, objection after objection is dealt with, because if you want to give the Darwinist credit for anything, It's for creativity.
Creativity.
And they'll come up with these various, well, maybe it was, you know, maybe it came about by this, maybe it came about by that.
It was an
every
RNA
one
world.
Of those, if you slow down and take them one at a time, they fall apart under closer inspection. So I say that because a lot of times you'll get a young person, their common sense will tell them, they'll have heard the basic form of the argument, and then they'll go into a biology class or something, and then a professor who's really good at bluffing, who's even bluffed himself, he's not lying, he's obviously truly convinced, will say, well, they didn't deal with this issue, or they didn't deal with neutral evolution, they didn't deal with such and such.
Right.
Just be aware, if this is something you want to pursue and go deeper with, know that there are answers to all those objections out there that try to get around what
and so,
is intuitively obvious once you actually look at the machinery, the sophistication of the cell.
And so
what
that
our
book,
intuition is telling us is that's designed.
And so that book is The Signature in the Cell.
Here that's another Discovery Institute fellow wrote that.
What's his name?
Stephen Meyer.
Oh, yeah. He's also so enjoyable to read. And as he speaks in some of these Discovery Institute documentaries, we sell three of the ones you guys have produced with Illustra Media. They are Darwin's Dilemma, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and The Privileged Planet. And with The Privileged Planet, you co-wrote the script, right? And I'd like to ask you about the brouhaha that erupted when Privileged Planet was scheduled to be screened at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. I think the New York Times said that it was about one of your books on Darwinism. They didn't even get the topic of the video right in the headline of their article.
Yeah, you could tell they weren't dialed in closely, that they weren't doing any kind of serious homework. They misrepresented the subject matter of the film. And what happened there is that it was going to screen there in the Smithsonian, and it did eventually, but the evolutionists, and I didn't even say Darwinist here, because The Privileged Planet deals with all the evidence for intelligent design before you even get the origin of life, how the Earth and the universe, how the laws and constants of physics are finely tuned to allow for life, none of which Darwin has anything to say about. So they just hadn't done their homework. They were just, as soon as they realized it was supporting intelligent design, they just went on the attack. And that's a classic example of these materialists, and I don't mean materialist in the sense of being greedy. I mean materialist in the sense that they're committed to this idea that matter is all there is. They claim they have this pose of being rational, of being the reasonable ones, but in fact, they refuse to consider the evidence for intelligent design. In fact, their methodology, called methodological materialism, strictly forbids them to consider intelligent causes
In your book, you guys, you and William Dembski, you quote Eugenie Scott on that topic, and she's saying that our method is methodological materialism, and that we can only look at matter to understand reality. And you guys point out that they're begging the question. This is circular reasoning. They're not proving that all there is matter. They're assuming it. And many in the public think that scientists have proved that all there is matter and energy. When they haven't proved that at all, they've simply assumed that.
Right. And they say, oh, so all scientists understand this. Well, talk to some Nobel laureates in physics and ask them what they think that the fine-tuning of the universe points to. There's some very prominent physicists who say it points to intelligent design, who have gone on record saying that. And of course, if they didn't, that wouldn't mean that it didn't point to intelligent design. But it is nice when the scientists are bluffing and saying, well, all reasonable scientists, all mainstream scientists understand that materialism is the case, or that there's no scientific evidence for intelligent design. It's good to be able to say, you know what? No, you're wrong there.
Yeah. They say all because they're ignoring all the scientists who disagree with them. So then it's easy to say all.
They either restrict it to biology, and then they still have to ignore some biologists that disagree with them, or they're just not doing their homework. I mean,
and they get a pass, of course, from the media. Now, logic is not material. The laws of logic are not physical. They don't have inertia. They have no mass. And so Eugenie Scott and others will use logic and reason, neither of which are material, to assert that the only thing that exists is matter in their methodological materialism. And it's not only circular, but it's directly self-refuting, because the logic, the laws of logic they're trying to use are not material.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is a lot of fun to think through and see where the errors creep in to their materialistic worldview. Can I ask you about, you bring up on, well, two examples on page 30 and then later in the book on 131. You guys talk about a creator and you talk about men like Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, who had a passion to study the universe, and they saw it as a mechanism that was designed by a supremely good and orderly creator. And here on Bob and Yurt Live and Real Science Friday, we are biblical creationists. That's what we call ourselves. And the intelligent design movement opposes Darwinism, but as I understand it, it does not take a stand for the creator of the Bible. Yet when I read your book, I was pleasantly surprised to see that you guys would talk about people who go to your meetings and they would go in as, you know, they admired the person, the figure of Jesus, but they entered as scientists and atheists, and they would leave as scientists and believers.
Right. And that happens in a circumstance, for instance, where maybe somebody knew about Jesus. Maybe they grew up aware of the Bible and Jesus and thought Jesus was a wonderful person, and maybe at one point thought he was the Son of God. But then they got brainwashed. That's kind of a harsh term, but got the propaganda started pouring in, maybe in high school, maybe in college, and convince them that, you know what, that's old-fashioned thinking. That's been disproved. If you're going to be reasonable and rational and modern, you need to put aside those childish religious beliefs. And so they already have that love for Jesus. They have an appreciation for, you know, that perfect law of God that you see in Jesus. But they've been told, can't believe in religion. That's childish. And then they go in, they see the evidence for intelligent design, and then, boom, it just clicks. And this isn't a standard experience. I wish every time we did an intelligent design talk, 80% of the non-believers walked out Christians.
Right.
But we have had examples of that. And the reason that the intelligent design is just making the scientific case isn't because most of the proponents of intelligent design, most of the fellows are Christians, like myself. But they're just making a distinction for the sake of clarity that intelligent design is focusing on the physical evidence for intelligent design. You can't tell from the physical evidence for intelligent design, for instance, that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God. That's where we have special revelation. That's where we can go to the evidence from history and learn that. But we're not going to go inside a cell, for instance, and say, you know, Jehovah God was here. So we can learn a lot from general revelation. I mean, David in Psalm 19, he talks about the heavens declaring the glory of God. But at that point, he's using that general name for God, El in Hebrew. And then when he goes to talk about that covenant name for God, Yahweh, he turns to that name when he starts talking about the law of the Lord is perfect. And so I think it's actually biblical to think about, you know, God giving a general revelation that tells all humanity there's a designer, there's a good creator out there, and then there's the special revelation, the Bible, that gives us the more intimate understanding of who that God is, who his son is.
Yeah, absolutely. The general revelation of creation, looking at the creation and being able to determine, because of the mind that God has given us, that there had to be a creator, which billions of human beings have had that experience. That doesn't prove it's right, but we could prove it's right in many ways. But billions of people have done that. And also God has written on our hearts his conscience, so that billions of human beings know right from wrong at a fundamental level. And even maybe the gang member who denies that he accepts the Ten Commandments, if you try to steal from him, he gets angry. And if you lie about him to his friends, he gets angry. If you try to take his woman, he gets angry. So even right. in their rejection, they're affirming the principles of morality that God has written on our hearts and revealed to us. When you said just a moment ago about in the cell, it would seem to me that what we see in the cell points as much to the glory of God as what we see in the heavens.
Oh, absolutely. It's just that, you know, when David wrote, they couldn't look into the cell.
No, right.
He could look at the glories of animals and the human being, but one of the gifts that God's given contemporary humanity is that the technology to look at the wonders of microscopic life.
Dr. Witt, your book is Intelligent Design Uncensored. You guys talk about the universe and the belief long ago by scientists that the universe was eternal. And that changed in the 20th century in a big way. And so the scientists, they reached the summit of the mountain and they found the theologians had been sitting there all along with the Bible saying that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So it's a paradigm shift for the entire scientific world to say, you know what? The universe did have a beginning. These stars have not been consuming fuel forever and ever.
Yeah, and that's an exciting story. It's also very telling because it was in, say the 1920s, that this shift began to occur with Hubble's discovery of the red shift, and then they later found the background radiation that was predicted by this idea that the universe came into being in a moment and expanded. But they already had a strong piece of scientific evidence that the universe was finite, and that is at least 100 years back. And that is with the discovery and the acceptance of the second law of thermodynamics, which says that the material world tends toward disorder. That unless you're getting inputs of energy from an outside source and have some sort of ordering system like we have on planet Earth with our living planet, things are going to move from order to disorder. If the universe were infinitely old, that would have already happened. We would be in a state of complete entropy. So there was already that evidence, but they resisted it for decades because there was this commitment to scientific project to try to keep God out of the picture, to have this self-contained universe that didn't need a creator. The story is a little more complex than that, but I think that's one of the key things that was driving that desire to avoid that. But then the evidence just got so powerful that as we got in deeper into the 20th century, it just became the standard view that the universe did come into being.
Yeah, and with
not infinitely old.
And with Ludwig Boltzmann's formulas on entropy and the realization that the whole universe, we wouldn't have stars that were tremendously hotter than the coldness of empty space. It would all be the same temperature because all available energy would have been used. And so we see when we look at the universe, it's dynamic. There's a lot of work going on. And so therefore, it could not have been here forever. So it must be recent. That's the second law of thermodynamics. And the first, that energy and matter, you could transfer one to the other, but a rock cannot make itself from nothing.
And right. So then you have the question of where did the universe come from? If it's not infinite, if it's not infinitely old, it's not eternal. It needed to come from somewhere. And some philosophers would argue, even if it's eternal, you still have the question of why it's here. But we don't have to get into that philosophical conundrum because we now know the universe isn't eternal.
Right. Now, Stephen
Hawking came into being, and so what made it come into being? Yeah, they can't avoid that question anymore.
Stephen Hawking, I think, does a sleight of hand when he answers that question. And to me, many of the most famous Darwinist and atheist and Big Bang cosmologist, they're brilliant, yes. They have very high IQs. But it seems like whoever could say the least absurd thing with the most straight face becomes a leader. And so Stephen Hawking says, well, the matter of the universe, we ask, where did the universe come from? He says, the matter of the universe was borrowed from the gravitational field of the universe, to which we ask, what universe? You can't borrow something from something that doesn't exist that you're trying to explain its origin.
Right, and then also you've got the gravitational field. Where's that come from? That's not, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not something. He hasn't explained that. So yeah, it's both encouraging to see them reduced to that level of absurdity, and it's also sad, you know, when we think in terms of a person who's that gifted intellectually, whose understanding has been darkened by their rejection of the clear evidence of nature that there is a creator.
So we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Witt with the Discovery Institute about his book, Intelligent Design Uncensored. And you bring up the issue of the atheist or the Big Bang cosmologist trying to explain how our universe is so tremendously fine-tuned with the many parameters that are set just right for life. And they try to explain this by saying that really there are billions of universes, maybe infinite universes, and we're just one of them. What are your thoughts on that answer that's frequently given?
They're actually committing a logical fallacy, and that is, imagine if you were gambling and you were sitting next to a guy that looked like he'd walked out of the Godfather movies.
Right.
And the guy behind the roulette wheel was kind of sweating and being very servile toward this man. And you and the Godfather-looking guy kept betting. And the Godfather guy won the first round of roulette, however big the roulette wheel is, maybe 1 in 30 chance. Like, oh, well, I guess lucky for him. And then he wins the next one, and he's piling up money, and he wins the third one. And you start trying to work out the odds, 30 times 30 times, wow, what a lucky guy.
Right.
And he does this another 7, 8, 9, 12 times. Would it be rational for you to go, boy, imagine how many people all over the earth, maybe all over the galaxy, all over the universe, maybe there are other universes playing roulette now so that there are enough roulette games going on to make it possible for this guy next to me to win 30, 50, 80, 100 roulette games right in a row and just to keep piling up the money. Man, isn't that amazing? If you were standing there and saw a guy reasoning like that, you would think he was an idiot.
Right.
Because he's obviously overlooking the obvious explanation, and that is that there's intelligent design going on. In other words,
his
Godfather
winning
character is threatening the roulette dealer and causing him to cheat for him. You wouldn't suppose that there were gazillions of roulette games going on all over the universe to make the odds of that tractable. But that's what the scientists actually do when they say, you know what, we have this finely tuned universe that there was a 1 in a Googleplex chance of it coming together. There must be an infinity of universes that we have no way of detecting or perceiving in any way that are out there to make this possible. So that's the kind of reasoning we're dealing with.
Well, we're running out of time, but Dr. Witt, Jonathan Witt, if you can remain with us a bit longer, we could keep going and then we'll have material for a second program. Will that work for you?
We can go a bit longer.
All right. Well, that's just super. You've been listening to Real Science Friday here at KLTT in Denver, a 50,000 watt station, and online at KGOV.com, or just go to Google, type in Real Science Friday, and you'll find it. We've got a great science department in our store, and you can get these wonderful DVDs, including The Privileged Planet.